Okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I'm going to add your mask.
How you doing?
Come up here.
We'll sit right there.
Yeah, I'm going to
sit right there.
That's
wrong. Wrong. Okay. All right.
Hey, Paul.
Hey, Sammy.
Welcome back.
All right, we're gonna get started in about 2 minutes. Give everybody get a chance to sit down. First of all, I want to welcome everyone to the Access to Healthcare and
push your button.
Oh, I should know that.
You should.
First of all, I want to welcome everyone to the Access to Healthcare Work Group Special Committee. And I am truly excited about it to have so many smiling faces in here today. And I just know that it's going to really do a great job. I know it's going to really be a great work. First of all, I want to start by thanking Council President Terrence Freeman. I know I've seen him somewhere in here. For having the vision to do this. This is very important. Also, I want to thank Chairman Boylan, for taking this task on. And actually asking me to do it because, as President Freeman knows, this year was going to ride out in the sunset. And wasn't going to do that much because, you know, last year being council president. But this is so important. I decided to come back out of semi-retirement for this. This is how important this is to me. And so I know this is going to be really great because Jacksonville, we definitely has to look at our healthcare issues, not only for our homeless population, for what we call, unfortunately, the working poor. That has a job and go to work every day, but still can't afford health care. And so now we're going to have introduction. We're going to start down there and work our way this way.
My name is Annie Seeger. I'm with the Northeast Board of Regional Council.
Yeah, I'm Beth Payne with the Regional Council.
Ron Salem, City Council Group 2 at large and Vice Chair of this esteemed committee.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Ryan. I'm the CEO of Volunteers in Medicine and co-chair with Paul on the committee.
Sam Newby, City Council.
And good afternoon, everyone. Paul Sapia. I'm a Population Health Strategy Principal for Humana, and so co-chair with Jennifer.
And Michael Boylan, District 6, also chair then of the Critical Quality of Life Issues Committee.
Before we get started, Council President Freeman, you want to say something first? Now, Chairman Boylan, you want to have something to say?
Thank you, Councilman Newby. I appreciate your leadership, and thank you for coming out of retirement, or semi-retirement. I really want to thank also Paul and Jennifer for quickly stepping up to the plate, understanding how much time and investment this is going to require, but I also know and appreciate the passion they have for it. Specifically, I want to recognize the folks from the Northeast Florida Regional Council. You saw a rather exhaustive development of an agenda for these five meetings, and Elizabeth and her staff was very helpful in helping us put that together. We're going to be hearing from Susan in a few minutes here about the state of the issue, and it says on the agenda Q&A afterwards, but I would encourage you to use that opportunity if you have a perspective that's broadens or is different than what Susan offers, I would suggest you use that time to do that. This is a process. We're not looking for resolutions or recommendations today. Today, the first item and the first focus is on the scope of the issue and understanding that. And so I would try and encourage you as best you possibly can to staying focused on what the deliverables are for today's meeting as you go forward. We had a great conversation this morning on the homeless issue, and I expect that equally one happening here today as well as tomorrow when we get into the attainable housing issues as well. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. And just like the chairman said, we want everybody to be interactive in this. It's not just us. It's all of us. It's a lot of great talent in here, and I know we're going to do a good job. So I want everyone to feel comfortable and interact. And if you have an opinion, please let us know. And so now I'm going to turn it over for overview to Jennifer and Paul.
Well, Michael kind of said it all, but really, you know, we're going to be here. We have meetings. Hopefully you all have them on your calendar. So that each meeting will have a purpose. Today is the overview of what the problem is. And Susan's going to do, you know, present that for us. But again, as Michael shared, if you have, we all have data, we all have information, please share that. Then our next meeting will be a presentation of best practices. So think about, as you're here, what is evidence-based that you've seen that works well, that we can then present at the next meeting, and also who else should be here?
Yeah, and so thank you, Jennifer. And I'm going to kind of go into my work group purpose and structure as well, since it kind of ties into the comments that we made. You are all the experts here. You've been part of this work in the community. You've been doing this work in the community for a long time. And so, as Jennifer mentioned, you know, you also know the others that should be here as well. Susan's going to talk about, you know, the scope of the issue and what really needs to change within this community. We know there are access issues, whether it be transportation, educational, getting people involved in this, you know, just going to the doctor, right? So there are a lot of components to this. And so as we build this program out, I really want us to think about how we lend our expertise, how we bring some knowledge, and think differently about this problem. You know, we all get involved in these issues that have been going on for decades, and then we have meetings like this for, you know, 5, 6, 8 hours, whatever it is, and we're expected to resolve them. And this is going to be something that really is a step in the right direction to improving access to healthcare in the community. So I really want everybody here to not be afraid to talk. That's what this is about. This is, you've got some ideas. Don't be afraid to share them. Don't be afraid to send it out. Even if it sounds silly, you never know what's going to happen. Okay, and I want to continue to bring different voices to this conversation. So, you know, the structure will be the 5 meetings that we have. Obviously, we'll share. We've got some different components of each of those meetings that we'll build off of. We really want this to be a meeting that comes to a conclusion that we are able to take a step in the right direction. So it's not going to be meetings to just share ideas. It's going to be meetings to come up with an intentional effort to change access to healthcare issues in the community. So thank you all for being here. I encourage participation and not waiting for the Q&A to raise your hand. So thank you all.
Thank you. So now we're going to go with the scope of the problem and turn it over to Jennifer, then she's going to introduce our guest speaker.
Okay. Excited to introduce you to Susan Gritch, if you don't already know her. She is a Jacksonville native, has been leading the Health Planning Council, and has been there for over 10 years. She also is the executive director of the St. John's Rural Health Network. She brings 4 decades of business, program, and financial expertise to the nonprofit and for-profit sectors. So thank you, Susan, for being here and highlighting the access to care issues here in Duval County.
Thank you. All right, I even wore high shoes so I could see everything. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Again, I'm just going to give you an overview of the access to health care issue. Forewarned, it's huge. So I'm going to give you some perspective today, but what I see through this process is you all that have so much to offer on this aspect will be able to offer different perspectives, perhaps different priorities. I'm just going to give you the perspective of the Health Planning Council. All right. And I have some notes because I've been known to have a senior moment here and there. Also, everybody gets to see our we haven't released it yet, but we have a brand new logo, the Health Planning Council of Northeast Florida. We've needed it. We've had about the same one for 40 years, so sneak peek up there. All right. Let's see if this works. Do I need to point it? Okay. Oh, okay. So, not going to spend too much time on this. I think you all know the Health Planning Council. We are a quasi-state organization. We are provided for in Florida statute 408.033. We are partially funded by the Florida Department of Health. And truly, our mission is to improve health outcomes by serving as a source for health information, data, analysis of that information, prioritization, and recommendations for implementation to influence better health outcomes. So that was a mouthful, but I think looking at the audience here, that probably all makes sense. Oh, and by the way, we are one of 11 health planning councils in the state of Florida. Florida has 67 counties. There are 11 health planning councils. We are the Health Planning Council of Northeast Florida. We serve the seven county area in Northeast Florida. Some of the services we provide is health planning, community engagement, strategic planning, and that's where I was talking about helping organizations and entities really define and prioritize what their most pressing health issues are, and in turn help them come up with a strategic implementation plan in order to achieve measurable outcomes in those areas. We also do program planning, development, and evaluation. Since we deal with a lot of federal contract funding, we do provide fiscal management services for entities and small organizations that may not have that expertise. We also do grant research, procurement, and administration. Right now we have grants through the CDC, DOH Duval, the City of Jacksonville, CMS, HHS, and HRSA. We also do programs for our local organizations. For instance, we just completed a needs assessment for Elder Sources so they could prioritize on what are the most priority aspects affecting the aging population, and we did it for the seven county area. The core of the Health Planning Council is really data collection. We have a very strong data aspect to our organization. And so we use a lot of data indicators as well as information from ACA to come up with information for hospitals, nursing homes, and other providers on utilization. Okay, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but the one thing I want to highlight is county health profiles. I think that information is going to be beneficial for this work group. We have just released our county health profiles, and they should be on our website. We're rebranding our website. But some of the aspects that we provide in the county health profiles is information on population, information on insurance rates, who has it, who is not, demographics, socioeconomics, access to education, MUAs and HIPSAs, medically underserved areas, and health provider shortage areas when we're talking about availability of providers and transportation in the built environment. So the three issues with this critical quality of life initiative are access to health care, affordable housing, and homelessness. Obviously, this work group is focused on access to health care, but definitely all three of those issues are interrelated, and aspects of one overlap into the aspects of another. So hopefully the outcome of these three work groups, we will be able to leverage the information and recommendations we have come up with to really come up with a plan of action on how to address this. The next one, on a very, very basic level, the scope of access to health care means everyone has appropriate personal health services available to achieve the greatest possible health outcomes. That is related to health equity. It is also related to removing or lessening the amount of health disparities of our populations, and specifically focusing on those vulnerable populations, the uninsured, the working uninsured, et cetera. So at a minimum, the different aspects of care, primary, specialty, hospital, emergency, and rehabilitative. Now this is where access to health care gets a little more complex. We talk about access to actual health care, but these challenges and barriers, lack of health insurance, poor access to transportation, whether that's geographically or financially, if people can't get to a provider or they don't have access to telehealth, how are they possibly able to get the health care they need, and more importantly, the level of prevention that really, really affects the amount of chronic disease in our county. I mentioned care provider shortages. We certainly have areas within our seven-county region where they just don't have enough providers. And that's a big, big contributor to lack of access to health care. Cultural and language differences. You know, providers need to be able to speak to their patients in a method in which the patients can understand. And so there is a whole body of work called CLASS, culturally linguistic, services. But it's meeting people where they are coming from. How do they understand? Listening to them. What are their priorities? And avoiding, as we have all experienced, going to our providers, the medical speak. We are not physicians. And so oftentimes having that understanding or the lack thereof really impacts a patient's ability to take that information home and make those lifestyle changes or understand the implications of not making those lifestyle changes. So that's a whole aspect in and of itself. And then again, limited preventative care resources. You know, that's where we want to get to. That's where we want to expand is access to health care, access to preventative services. Let's help people avoid chronic disease, avoid diabetes, avoid heart disease. So the scope of the issue is huge, and so the reason I mention that, I think that one of the things we're going to have to think about in this work group is what are we really going to focus on? We can't fix all of this, certainly not within this time frame. We can certainly speak to them in the final report, but we're really going to have to come up with some goals and objectives and recommendations to a specific area that we think we will have the biggest positive impact on access to health care. And again, just to make it very simple, insufficient access to primary care, leads to compromised care and preventative measures, which leads to negative healthy outcomes and affects long-term quality of health. And again, this is just kind of a reiteration of there, you know, what's preventable and treatable health needs. Early detection, mammograms, having your CBCs done for diagnosis of hidden issues, complete blood count, chronic disease management, preventative care, flu shots, COVID vaccines, blood pressure, cancer screenings, things like that. One of the questions posed was, what are entities within the public, private, nonprofit sectors currently doing to address each issue? I've listed just a very small list there. Here in our community, we have the FQHCs, Agape, Sulzbacher, with low-cost or no-cost care, volunteers. Says volunteers in medicine. That's no-cost care, including specialty care, for the working uninsured. They're working, but they don't have enough money to have actual health insurance. We Care Jabs, great organization, coordinates specialty care for the uninsured. And UF Shands, through the help of the City of Jacksonville, provides treatment, emergency room treatment, which is not great, but for the indigent who, again, they probably don't have a primary health care provider because they're probably not insured. Best practices or policies that other communities have adopted. For this discussion, I'm going to focus on affordable health care and health insurance. I think it's the easiest to use data to capture, and I think it's the easiest and probably biggest aspect that affects health disparities is insurability, and if you are insured or you are not. So one of the things the Health Planning Council does is we are going into our 10th year of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act Navigator Program, whereby we send out navigators, and we do virtual work as well, through outreach in the 7-county area. And we help folks understand what insurance options are available to them. I don't know if any of you all deal with your organization's health insurance options every year. I have that lovely responsibility. It is very complex, and it takes, you know, a great bit of study and reading through the lines to see really what sort of benefits you're getting. For the casual observer, casual individual, going to healthcare.gov and trying to determine what insurance is best for them. And there might be a low copay, but the deductible could be $14,000. So what we do is through outreach, we navigate all of these areas through outreach, and we have obviously culturally and linguistically appropriate personnel to help those who may not use English as their primary language. They're very, very experienced in just taking the confusion and, you know, policy premium speak and bringing it into an understandable format. I don't have the specs today, but if we want to focus on this, obviously, in another workshop, I can have that information for you all about how many people have been reached, how many people have been signed up for health insurance, and it is a significant figure. And again, providing affordable options, you know, our navigators can really work with someone based on their specific and individual needs and find a health insurance option for them that is reasonable and acceptable and doesn't have any hidden surprises. So that's about the Navigator program, because that's what the Health Planning Council does. Now, other entities that work with these issues, obviously the Health Planning Council of Northeast Florida through the marketplace, the City of Jacksonville, you know, helping fund a portion of UF, and other agencies, large employers. I actually have a longer list here. Certainly Florida Blue and Humana. hospital systems. There's just a long, long list of entities that are available to help with address this issue of access to health care. Now, these next few slides, I'm going to kind of go through them really quickly. You all probably are very well aware of this, but this is a frightening thing that is about to occur. It's called Medicaid unwinding. When COVID hit, the government instituted a public health emergency, and basically that expanded Medicaid coverage. So this public health emergency, everything's been great. This includes children on Medicaid. Well, that public health emergency is ending, and they are going to provide 60 days to folks who have been eligible to Medicaid, not just through the public health emergency, but also people who are on Medicaid before the public health emergency. I think that the phrase I would use, and I hope nobody here is going to be offended by this, but from what I've seen, and I am not a subject matter expert on Medicaid, but lack of planning and implementation. For instance, I've got some stats for you. Hold on. Okay, last bullet. If an enrollee does not respond to the Medicaid provider reaching out saying you're going to have to reapply for Medicaid, they're automatically removed from Medicaid. They will be without insurance. A status was provided for me by, let's see, what's the name? I just want to let you know I didn't make this up. data from a presentation from the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation, Office of Health Policy. They estimate that of the children who are eligible for Medicaid, ages 0 through 17, 3 out of 4 will lose their Medicaid eligibility. Just through churning, they just call it administrative churning, it's people falling in and out of the system, joining and leaving. And it appears at first view that, you know, the process is to try to get in touch with people and try to respond to get eligible for Medicaid. Well, that... I mean, that in and of itself, I think, speaks for itself. You know, a lot of people on Medicaid are elderly. Many people on Medicaid may have cultural or literacy issues. We can't promise that every case manager for Medicaid is going to reach out to all of their customers in a timely fashion. So the reason I focus on this is access to health insurance, albeit access to health care, is about to get much more significant. So when we talk about access to health care in light of the critical quality of life issues, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. So in case you didn't know about it, I just want you to just keep your ear out for Medicaid unwinding. I don't mean to be a cynic, but it concerns me. Some specs, this is nationally, but... Well, here's Duval. As of June 31st, 280,000 people are on Medicaid. Of those, I'm not sure 280,000 are really going to be able to respond in a timely manner and become eligible again. So that's a significant number for our county. On a national standpoint, about 15 million individuals will leave the program. 8.2 will leave Medicaid due to loss of eligibility, and they'll have to transition to another source of coverage. Well, anybody that knows about insurance knows that there is a delay oftentimes before you move from one level of insurance to another. And if you think about the children or the elderly, you know, being without insurance coverage for even a few weeks could have really, really, really detrimental effects. And then here's this. 6.8 million will lose Medicaid coverage despite still being eligible, although Department of Health and Human Services is taking steps to reduce this outcome. Again, TBD on that. I don't have all the details, but if we want to delve into that during the work group, we can. Maybe even through the SWOT analysis aspect. And this is just more information about it. The public health emergency was supposed to end and then extended and then end and then extended. They're only going to provide a 60-day notice to Medicaid folks and say, after 60 days, you have no insurance. And again, 383,000 individuals projected to lose eligibility for Medicaid would fall in the coverage gap. And again, 3 out of 4 children ages 0 to 17 are expected to lose coverage. So, this is my thought process here. And again, this is where I really want everybody to bring in their opinions and their expertise, because a lot of us work in healthcare access. We have a lack of healthcare access insurance. That is obviously a barrier to preventative and regular healthcare. But we also have the transportation barrier, whether it is someone's in a rural area and they can't get to Jacksonville to go to a hospital, especially when they're a vulnerable population. They might not physically be near a bus stop. They may not have the agility to do so. So that's a big barrier. I think telehealth can really, really address this barrier. But when we talk about rural populations, often rural populations do not have the broadband infrastructure to support telehealth. So that's not an easy fix either. That's talking about getting lines, you know, fiber in the ground. Care provider shortages, certainly we can provide data on where those are and how much, what areas of Duval County are experiencing that, and see if that's really something that we're in a position to do anything about, or more importantly, recommend individuals or entities or hospitals on, you know, they're well aware of this, but how to lend our support to help get more providers in these underserved areas. Again, working on, you know, cultural and language differences, so that when there is access to health care, that the provider and the patient are communicating, they understand each other, the patient leaves the appointment with a clear understanding about what they need to do to optimize their own health and make sure that they can take that home with them, you know. Some doctors talk to you the whole time and you're so busy listening you don't have time to take notes. My primary care physician prints out a document of everything we talked about. That's where we need to be. That is fabulous. And then again, limited preventative health care resources. So when we talk about how are we going to address this very complex and interwoven issue of lack of access to health care, I think that we need to make the following considerations. We have a relatively short time frame. We're going to have 5 work group meetings. And you all have seen, you know, what the objective is of each work group. And I think that's a great start. We have to kind of get our eye on the ball and look at and say, what is reasonable for us to achieve by December when the final report is due? And reasonable can be the scope of the work, the detail of the information we provide, and then that is also affected by the fact that we all have jobs, and so time is a resource that is very valuable to us as well. And then take a long look at this and see what is attainable and set reasonable objectives, reasonable time frames, reasonable goals. Health planning, I'm a planner. We need to scope this thing out and agree about how we're going to address everything, put together an outline, put together a timeline, and work to it. Because we need to ensure that we have something to present in December. So that's what I see, you know, those are our next steps. I'm just speaking from the Health Planning Council. We get all of our information from evidence-based data, Florida Charge, American Consumer Survey, Behavioral Risk Factors, Surveillance Systems, Population, etc. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we as a work group are going to focus on lack of health insurance. That's just my professional opinion as to something that we can make some real steps forward. And even just on a smaller schedule, you know, I've been a longtime advocate of all of these safety net agencies that do so much for our vulnerable populations. I'd like to see more funding go to them. They provide all of this free care to the working uninsured or the uninsured, volunteers in medicine. My gosh, all of those volunteers, those physicians and clinicians give of their time. And I think investing in these safety net agencies is an important aspect of addressing this issue in addition to the insurance portion. And then again, any of the agencies that provide services, Healthy Start, maternal and fetal medicine, FQHC, Sulzbacher. I mean, I think we really need to come together and say, where do we think we can make a difference? And what do we need to get there? And I think that, you know, putting that all together in a report that has a clear, you know, evidence-based data platform, but also recommendations that are realistic, is one step forward to us addressing access to health care.
So, Susan, I have a quick question for you. Can you go back to the Navigator program that you have to talk about insurance? I think one of the issues that, you know, we've learned a lot about in the work that we've done is just knowledge of what's out there, right? The knowledge of going to the primary care or what access there is to insurance. When we start talking about funding, you know, that becomes a little more sustainable. If we're able to get people into health insurance plans and they don't have to put things out of pocket, and we as corporations or whatever don't have to continue to support, you know, a lot, not that we wouldn't support, but, you know, continue to put funding, it becomes more sustainable. So when we start to think about, you know, access to health care or access to health insurance or just the providers themselves, it's the knowledge that they're there. And so if you can talk a little bit more about the Navigator program, because I'd love to think about how we enhance that, maybe utilizing community health workers and others to really tell the story about the options that are open for people.
And that's a great question, because actually we have a couple of grants for COVID vaccine education and outreach with the goal of going into areas and helping folks understand the actual facts regarding the vaccine and, you know, managing the excessive and often contradicting information that we all get thrown at us through different sources of media. The Navigator program has recently decided, because we do, through that program, engage a lot of community health workers and then what we call community health advocates, because they don't necessarily need to have that CHW licensure. We just do training for them in relation to COVID. But we have started piggybacking on these outreach events. We have outreach events almost every weekend, several times a week. They're usually in community centers, they are churches, they are libraries, places where people just congregate. Definitely trying to focus on communities, because communities usually have, and the smaller the better, the communities usually have kind of a shared outlook towards the COVID vaccine. And so we piggyback on that by doing Navigator outreach events, and we have found that to be very successful, because we want to take advantage of groups that are already there instead of saying, okay, I know you're spending Saturday afternoon here. We need to also have your family come Sunday here to talk about the Navigator. So we're piggybacking on that. At the Health Planning Council, we actually came up with a virtual outreach program for the Navigator program about 8 years ago. It was way before COVID and everybody being on Zoom and Teams. such that the Navigator program utilized that as their best practices. So we do also do a lot of outreach to folks that may not be able to leave their homes. You know, all those aspects, all those barriers, bilingual, you know, communications, etc. The Navigator program has been incredibly successful. We are actually a sub-awardee. CMS awarded the University of South Florida the Navigator program. And we are a few sub-awardees in the state of Florida, but I will say that the Health Planning Council's facilitation of the Navigator program has been number one in the state. We are, again, just getting more funding. It used to be like nothing, and then it went down to really nothing, and now USF, we just found out, over and above the annual funding, they just got an additional $12 million. So the funding is there. There can always be more outreach. We see this with our COVID numbers. It is a direct, it is a numbers game. The number of times that you meet with individuals or you communicate with individuals, and it's on a one-on-one basis, and they can ask their specific questions and voice their specific concerns. You know, one of our tenets is listen, stop talking. Okay? We want to talk to people about what their concerns are and answer their questions. And again, answer their questions utilizing evidence-based data. There is such a trust issue that, you know, we also work with places of worship, primary care providers, so that those individuals that community members trust can actually communicate that message and provide some linkage to us. So I don't have numbers right now with the number of uninsured, you know, as of 10 years ago to the number of uninsured today. Well, I know there's in Duval, there's like 985,000, you know, all the data is a little delayed, right? Because they post it a little late. But like out of 985,000 people in Duval, I think almost 12% are uninsured. Yeah. But we've really made a big, big impact through that. So we're finding that this program of outreach and education is effective.
Thank you. So how are we going to do the Q&A instead?
Sorry. Oh, go ahead. Angel's train had something back there.
Yeah, no. How are we going to do it instead? Everybody raising their hand at one, and I'm not a very good teacher. So how are we going to do it? We're going to go by row. If you have a question, then you ask the question. Then we're going to start with the front row, and then at the end we'll have a front. Yeah. So anybody in the front row have a question? No, we're going by the, you're on the side. Front row first.
Good afternoon. I'm Tiki James Holland with Elder Source. Thank you, Jeremy Newby, Jeremy Borland, and committee for this forum. So we have worked with you. We just worked with you on our needs assessment and got some really good information as it relates to the senior population and those living with disabilities, which we serve in the Seven County area. In what you have researched and what you presented here today, what have you seen as it relates to the social determinants of health and how that is becoming a focus, not just you know, locally, but on a federal as well as state level? Because, of course, as you know, with our work, we've seen that you know, providing the social and economic and location-based services really produce optimal health outcomes and has become a real focus of that. And that's something I know that we are focusing on, you know, the nutrition, you know, services, the transportation, making home modifications so that individuals can maneuver within their homes and as well as caregiver support. So what have you seen as it relates to that?
Well, that's a very good question. I didn't really focus on the social determinants of health. But, you know, all of the aspects over and above access to clinical care or prevention are called the other social determinants of health. And again, these can be things like, we keep using lack of transportation, but socioeconomic status, age, gender, level of education, all of those aspects. And up until this issue and with COVID and things becoming much more apparent, it always used to be, and two different entities, I think it's the CDC and the WHO, again, backed up, but that those social determinants of health that have nothing to do with access to health care were between 70% and 80% more, had more of an effect on your quality of health and health outcomes, and that the access to clinical care was 20% to 30%, meaning your geographical zip code, what really, really affects you and your health care more than your genetics and your access to care. But we're seeing a difference with that because of the fact that health insurance costs are so expensive. Small organizations often can't afford to provide health insurance to their employees. The Affordable Care Act, it has some great aspects if you're completely within poverty levels. But for someone who's just can't afford health insurance, but they're not their income is not low enough to really take advantage of the ACA, there's a gap there, and they can't afford the health insurance. It's not that they can't afford the premiums. It's not that they can't get the tax credit. It's that their deductible is just crazy. So much has been going on over the past few years with health insurance, and then we take on the fact that the COVID pandemic really exacerbated the problems of health disparities. It really increased them, and it became more visible to everyone. And so I believe that that pendulum is swinging. I think that, again, COVID's terrible, but I think it's brought to more people's attention that the fact that healthcare is taking a higher step on the rung of the ladder. So again, the social determinants of health, those things that lead to the health disparities, very, very important. Very, very important when we are looking at the overarching goal of improving health outcomes and quality of life. So my impression is that lack of access to clinical care is now moving up in that priority.
Okay, great. Great president, great answer. But Susan, I'm probably going to need you to cut the answer part down to about 2 minutes per question.
Okay.
I know it's going to be tough, but,
I can chat.
Because we have so many questions.
I meant to set an alarm.
So. Okay, the next person. Next row.
My question is, in barriers that you were thinking about earlier, the disability barrier, if I can obtain health insurance, if I have access to transportation, if I don't have a language barrier, but actually going to the doctor and being physically seen is a barrier.
Yes.
Going to the hospital is a barrier. Going to access kind of preventive care is a barrier. One of the things you mentioned was a health screening, like a mammogram. Mm-hmm. Well, I asked, they were like, we have no idea. Okay, so do you take a look at the barriers for people with disabilities that have, good health insurance, have access to transportation? But then it stops with actually medical care being obtained.
We do. Again, we have data on that as well. And I completely understand what you're talking about. My mother herself is in a wheelchair, and she's 90. And the doctor says, well, come in. I'm going to check on you. That is an incredibly challenging thing for her to do. I know that there are mobile mammograms now. I know that we as a country are working towards addressing those specific health disparities for those folks that there are just so many barriers to actually getting the health care. We as kind of a health data organization, we capture the statistics. But capturing that evidence-based data is what helps feed policymakers and insurance companies where their gaps are. And that's clearly a gap. So I couldn't speak to when they're going to be fully addressed, but I can tell you that we capture that information.
Hi, It's more of a comment. So I understand what you're asking about with the social determinants of health, and I just wanted to share a couple of things. So our hospital systems worked with the Community Council, and we actually produced our community health needs assessment. And what was really important for us is to actually highlight the social determinants of health throughout the community health needs assessment, because really when we talk about access to health care, I mean, that health care component is only 20% of the 80%. And a lot of our actual feedback, I have some of it pulled up, was when asked during the survey, when the comment of what keeps me from being healthy, it really was the social determinants of health, right? So it was gaps in dental care, it was a lack of provider, I think the awareness of services. I think some of the comments was, if I don't have a navigator in the system actually telling me what's out there from a social services perspective, mm-hmm. I don't know that the Sulzbacher Center is located in my neighborhood. I don't know that Mission House is located. I don't know that there's Hearts for Minds that's there that's providing resources for mental health. And I think that was a lot of the comments that was there as well. And then in addition, with that too, they also talked about the economic instability, the poor neighborhoods, I think really contribute to the access to healthcare. Transportation, I think, should be probably one of our focuses. It showed up in all five counties as a major issue that we have. And then also the quality food and healthcare threatening the health and well-being. So just wanted to make some of those comments. The report is public for people to see. I think that is some of the data that we really should look at when we look at access to healthcare. And then the last comment I'll make, because I don't want to take up too much time, is really the LGBTQ plus community was highlighted throughout the report. I think many members of that community are losing insurance, right? And so therefore they don't have access to care. And then throughout the report also we highlighted disability to make sure that we highlight the concerns there.
Can you state the name and the organization that you're from?
Yep, Mayo Clinic.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else on that row?
I am Mary Pat Corrigan with Sulzbacher. Just a quick question. In this, where is dental? Where do you include that? Is that included in the scope? Is it not? Should it be? We see a huge demand. Nobody anywhere.
So, Mary Pat, I think as we're thinking of this, we think of it as holistic, right? It's got to be dental. It's got to be mental health. It's got to be entire. We've talked about social determinants of health. That's my job. Okay, that's what I do with Humana for the state of Florida, right, as we start to look at all these components. So I don't want us to think just primary care access. I want us to think access to health care and those things that happen outside of the doctor's office, that 80% of outside of that 15-minute doctor's office visit that can impact health. And so, you know, we want to keep this open and help you guys help us decide where we want to go with this. And I think there's a lot of expertise. We've got all the hospitals represented, I believe, here, and a lot of our great nonprofit providers as well. So we need to think of mental health and dental as well on this.
Great. Anyone on that row, the second row on this side? Oh, the gentleman. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I didn't see you.
Yeah, Derek, you know, Lightree Women Care as well. I sort of wanted to piggyback off of what she was saying, off of a little bit of the data that I was reading as well. And the patients that we're seeing is they're not aware of these social services and these events that's out in the community. So I would say maybe we may be able to look at a different way or set aside additional funding for specifically marketing and in a mass media type of way to let people know that these services are out there, because we're running into that a lot now. We have been working with Northeast Florida Community Partners with the Community Outreach Department, doing a great job, and just having them in our facility being able to educate these patients and let them know it's been tremendous. So when you look at that and you say, well, how do they not know that we have these safety nets out there, maybe we do need to set aside additional funds specifically for these organizations and their marketing, because I've also spoken with a few leaders with some of the nonprofits, and that's something that they're facing. Now, they have an operations budget, they have to get these grants, and they're also, they have to pay physician salary, they have to keep the lights on, things of that nature, when it comes to their marketing budget to really get it out there, that sort of gets left out. So now we are relying on the other messages of the community outreaches, which is great, but you want to reach so many people in those forms. I think they need to have an increased budget to be able to advertise also over social media, over the airwaves, on TV, to give a centralized service or a number to let people know that these safety care programs are out there.
Thank you. Anybody on the panel want to respond to that?
Well, I would like to share. It hasn't been brought up, and I know that's why Angela Strain was raising her hand. And I'm keeping a list of the data that we're discussing, and we will follow up with all the data, the community health needs assessment, the county health profiles. I'm also going to ask if we can get zip code level data on some of this, more than just county, and we will share this with the group after this meeting. But there is a group that was formed by all of the safety net organizations, including the FQHCs. It's called Jack's Care Connect. It's only been around for about a year and a half, but its goal is to link the uninsured in our community to primary care clinics based on their need. And also they are helping go into, they actually come to our clinic and they talk with people about the social determinants of health. If there's things besides just their healthcare visit they're concerned with, things like housing, food assistance, things like that. But it is kind of in a pilot phase, looking to expand, but there is something like that, and I can share these. I think it'll be a good, as you're thinking about the next meeting, we're going to be talking about best practices, so be thinking about those things that we can then share with the group at the next meeting.
So, and I know that there's a few people here that have been involved in the conversations on Unite Us and Aunt Bertha and some of those community health resource directories. You know, if you think, I was thinking the same thing as you, Jennifer, is Jack's Care Connect. But looking at ways to increase the utilization, the participation by the nonprofits or by the organizations that are safety net providers in something like that. So do we have a community-wide, easily accessible resource directory that gets information into people's hands? I think that's something that, you know, we need to consider as well as part of this.
Yeah.
Thank you. Paul Podesk with Ascension St. Vincent's, part of the hospital partnership group, and with CHA with Health Planning Council. I wanted to say the same kind of comment is that healthcare by design is so complicated, and as we talk about having a community health worker, community navigator, of course, that's really short term. That's an immediate fix for patients that need that education that is so complex, not to use EDs as their primary care, and also expand into that specialty care. I also have to give a voice to vision is priceless. With vision care, as we've seen, that's so elemental, especially with children. The younger just can't even perform at the academic level without it. But speaking of upstream solutions, as you talked about kind of a systemic issue of that conversion, that Medicaid unwinding, and that 60-day notice for conversion. And this is probably a very involved question, but whenever you look at Health Planning Council and the navigators that enroll people in insurance and the Affordable Care Act, what is the conversion ratio, do you know? If we were to talk about enrolling people in healthcare, I'm sure it's not 100% can come to you, as you've talked about. Some of it's just too expensive. People just cannot afford health insurance, right? No matter what poverty level they're at. Do you know that conversion ratio and how much is missed, what that gap is?
I don't have that data with me, but we have that data. And interestingly enough, our navigators have just been notified that they're going to need to be able to speak to Medicaid unwinding. Haven't heard anything about any training, but we'll figure it out.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Cindy Funkhauser, Sulzbacher. I just wanted to tag on to what this gentleman was saying. We have capacity in the social service network, in the healthcare safety net network. There's capacity. So instead of talking about adding more services and whatnot, we need to make sure we're utilizing the capacity we have. In order to do that, we do need marketing. We do need to be able to get that out there. So that's one thing I wanted to say. That's the most important. Use the capacity we have and make sure that's being utilized before we start worrying about adding capacity. Secondly, with the marketplace, the Affordable Care Act, there is a lot of more than education, Paula, that needs to be done there. When people come to Volunteers in Medicine or our waiting room, they're not going to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. They're getting it for free. Why would they sign up for the Affordable Care Act? It makes no sense, and they don't do it. So what you need to figure out is, what's the income level where people might actually be able to sign up for it? Those are the people you focus on. You don't come to my waiting room or her waiting room where people are getting great quality care. That's just a piece of advice. That's a waste of time. So we need to make sure that we're targeting the right people with the right intervention. And I would just say, also from a numbers perspective, so according to your 985,000 people, 12% uninsured, that's 118,000 people. We need to focus on that 118,000 people. That's what we need to be focused on. Mm-hmm. The folks that have Medicaid, a lot of them are children, right? So not very many of them are adults at all, because we didn't bother expanding Medicaid. So I think we need to look at this in buckets. It's not all one great big problem. It's a bunch of separate problems. And you have to address each of those separate demographics separately. So my point of it is, yeah, it's a big complex problem, but you break it down, how do you eat an elephant, one bite at a time, and we need to be strategic and not think you know, everybody's going to get in the marketplace. Because they aren't. They can't afford it, and we need
right.
to figure out who can afford it and target them, and then we need to really make sure we're using capacity in the system that we already have. It's just my comments.
Thank you. Anybody on the committee want to add to that? Up here?
No, I think, Cindy, and thank you for talking about capacity, because I think that there's other things. There's other voices that haven't been part of this conversation. You know, I'm thinking of Johnson & Johnson Vision Care, right? And I know they do work with Vision is Priceless, right? Have they been a part of these conversations? I've got a note to reach out to them, right? There's capacity in the public sector, in the private sector. You know, there's capacity to make a change. And it's making sure we're telling that story to the right people to make a difference. And we start to look around at other communities across the country that are doing this more intentionally. And I think that's where we kind of lean is, to your point, we all have lanes that we can swim in. And we can start to tackle those things within our scope. And it all is working in the same direction. So I think that's, you know, something we really need to continue to focus on as part of this group.
Thanks. Go ahead.
So, excuse my military moment. Can you raise your hand if you have lived experience around this topic? And then, raise your hand if you're in healthcare and you've been nodding for the last couple of years. I'm just being frank. Yeah. I love this. I think it's important. I know we have to set a tone. But I'm with my dear friend Cindy. Let's find out the buckets. Let's ask us at UF. What are the buckets for the city contract chance card that include them primary care and specialty care? And what are the buckets at Salzburg? And then we'll find that sweet spot that maybe we can deliver to council something in 90 days. It's just my comment.
Okay. Anyone over here? Before Mr. Chairman, Vice President.
Thank you, Chairman. I could not agree with the last couple of comments. Knowing the council that I do, they're going to want a few actionable items where we can make a difference. It's a big picture, but we've got to, through this process, I'm in healthcare, as most of you know. I'm a pharmacist. And I've dealt with this issue for 40 years. But in this case, we've got to get 3-4 very specific actionable items that we can put some money towards, and hopefully we can move the needle. We might not solve it, but we can move the needle. And I can't reinforce that enough as we go through this process. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Sherman.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Lynn Sherman, and I work at Baptist Health. And I want a couple things. One thing I want to do is give voice to the comments that was made about the need for awareness and marketing in this community. We have all of us who work with hospitals in this room are very familiar with the clinics, the safety net clinics that we have. But we also are very familiar with the fact that they can't market. They don't have the dollars to do that. And we also realize that there are people who are out there in our community who have no clue that they exist. And I am giving voice to what Cindy has said and the gentleman before her and Marie. It is so important that we let people know that these things exist. And when we do that, we decrease the stigma associated with them too. Because now everybody's doing it, and I'm not just, I don't have insurance, but I'm not having to go to a free clinic because it's common. And there is stigma associated with going to some of these clinics, and we can do something about that. As a community, we can do something about that. And it's going to take money, Councilman Salem. It's going to take money for us to do that. So the question is, how much money you got? Because we can make it happen, and all of us in the room can make it happen. So the question is, how much money you got? Because this is a problem that does not have to exist. There are multiple social determinants of health that's been mentioned repeatedly because our community health needs assessment is bleeding with it, and the evidence is there. So now, what do we do to make a difference? So we can talk all day long, but let's do something.
Okay.
Called me out. I think that's before answering. Yeah.
Go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn, for sharing that. You know, and this is a process, and I wanted to make sure we stay to the process. Yeah. I think what I've learned already today that, you know, obviously education and outreach is a big part of what we need to do. But let's not jump to the conclusions of what needs to, you know, what the solutions are at this point in time. I'm a process guy, so bear with me as we go through this. But I've learned a lot from this process already. And I just want, I didn't mention this before, and I want to interject, and I apologize for doing so. You know, our role, the council role in this process, is a convening group. We, you know, we don't have the wherewithal, the knowledge, the expertise that all of you do. So we're very fortunate to have all of you here doing this, because just right now, as you saw, you are creating the lanes that we need to operate in to get to attainable goals and reasonable goals. And so I just want to comment how much I appreciate your feedback.
And I also want to say to piggyback off the chairman, this is a process. It's maybe long, maybe slow, but it is a process. And Lynn, you know, you're one of my favorite people, but it's a process. Just be patient.
Okay.
Thank you. Hi, Angela Strain with We Care Jacksonville. I'm a process person, and my life motto is carpe diem, so I want to know about what's happening before we choose the lane. But 114,000 adults in our community are uninsured, but they're not a monolithic group. So I want to make sure that we stratify our approach and look at, just as some of the other folks have said, there are buckets. One thing that hasn't been talked about yet is that to purchase the Affordable Care Act plan, you have to have a minimum income of $13,000. That sounds like a lot. We've looked at the data. There's about 40,000 of our uninsured neighbors who don't meet that standard. So just looking at what we do at We Care Jacks, 76% of our patients are under 100% of poverty. Jacks Care Connect today, in fact, at 3:30, is going to be releasing some data about its first year. And because of COVID, what we had anticipated seeing in the folks who do call to get that connection to care, unfortunately, 62% in the first year were unemployed, and that was an unexpected number to have. So when we look at that big number, there's going to be different solutions for each one of the groups that were in it, and I just want to make sure we don't think that there's a panacea, that there's a magic bullet for the whole group, because there's not.
Okay. The next person.
Hi, Meredith Smith with Jax Care Connect as well. I'm sorry, We Care Jacks. I just wanted to thank the woman who spoke and shared her personal experience in the front row because she represents the very issue that we're trying to address. And I wanted to also point out that the safety net is far and wide in Jacksonville, as I'm discovering as a transplant to Jacksonville. I'm learning every day about new organizations, nonprofits who are helping address the social determinants of health that are rampant in Jacksonville, with disparities of people who are struggling to just survive literally. And I want to point out that in addition to that, there's Mass Clinic, who I just came from a visit, who is seeing patients actively while we were there. And we have that safety net across our 800 square miles.
I'm Lorraine Husband with Feeding Northeast Florida, and I'm pretty much here just to make sure that we recognize food as medicine. And you can either have really good food that improves your health conditions, or you can have bad food that exacerbates your health conditions. But I also wanted to bring up the Medicaid unwinding issue. So some of the actionable items that we can that can come out of this group is how are we going to prevent that? Because that's something we can do, is to come up with a community plan to make sure that we don't have so many people falling off Medicaid, because when they do, that will increase our food lines and also your healthcare lines, et cetera, et cetera. So what do we do with that?
I think for us to actually engage in the Medicaid unwinding, first of all, we'd have to have access to whom has Medicaid. I'm not sure with HIPAA that would be information that would be shared with us. However, most Medicaid recipients have a case manager, and that might be the avenue to communicate proactively with. And just, if nothing else, for a sense of, are you dealing with this, you know? I don't have the answers. I really don't. I just see it coming, and I think that certainly internally with our Navigator program, we're going to be talking a lot about what we can and cannot do.
So,
yes,
yeah,
I agree. And you know, to Cindy's point earlier and to everybody's point, I think that's the whole beauty of this workshop. We all have different perspectives and expertise to bring to the table. And I think that communicating with one another, we will find mutual solutions that are very doable. And so, just like you were saying, Lorraine, with the Medicaid unwinding and, you know, talking about food deserts, I mean, all of those issues, I think that it's important for us to note those issues, make the report aware, in the report provide awareness of those issues, and then, again, with the SWOT analysis and the normal process of basic strategic planning, we'll all come together and come up with what are some recommendations for the priorities that we need to address. This having a resource directory or database available to our community is critical. And that's just a matter of coordination, having a central repository, and then pushing it out on every platform and every method possible. Again, it takes funding, and it takes participation by all of us. But clearly that is a gap that is an important priority as well.
Yeah, and so Susan and Lorraine, when you're talking about the Medicaid unwinding, it's something, you know, from the insurance side that our Medicaid teams are very aware of and really diligently trying to address. We are looking at this. So when you start talking about the case managers and reaching out to them, maybe it's better to go to the leaders of the Medicaid plans in this area, mm-hmm. right? To start to build a story that we can tell in an outreach plan with those people, so we start to tackle it from a larger aspect, right? It's not going to the case manager that has 100 people. It's going to the Medicaid people that have 500,000 people, right? And creating a plan to build awareness around what to do and how do we get to those people. Because in that aspect, there's lanes there, too. There are uninsured people. There are homeless people that, you know, we have to go out to the homeless camps. We actually send teams out to the homeless camps to try to contact people. And so, you know, it's a big story. So I will offer up Humana's Medicaid person if we want to have a conversation with them about, you know, what we're doing to address the unwinding. And I'm sure the other Medicaid plans in the area would be willing to do that as well.
Right. Jennifer, you want to comment on that?
You read my mind, but I'm a part of the Florida Association of Free and Charitable Clinics, and so is Jamie. We're both on the board, and just today we were discussing advocating to increase the federal poverty level because of that issue right there. But I think that is a huge. You're exactly right, and something we need to all be needs to be on our radar.
And so, Jennifer, I'm a part of the Florida Chamber of Commerce Foundation Prosperity Initiative. And so looking at issues across the state of Florida and looking at the most, you know, the zip codes with the most poverty. And one of the things we've talked about is benefit cliffs. And we had somebody from the Federal Reserve that was talking. And there's actually conversations around changing policy that so that people don't lose their benefits when they get an increase in salary or they change their jobs. It's not an automatic disqualification for your benefits. So there is conversation going on that, and I think that, you know, continuing the free and charitable clinics and others advocating for change there, I think that's, you know, an unintended consequence of some decisions made a long time ago that probably could be changed.
All right, thank you. So now we're going to go into, I think we already did it, but we're going to go into member discussion. Jennifer, I think.
Well, is there anything, you know, that was kind of a Q&A, but it did become a discussion, which is wonderful. Is there any other discussion that the group has? You know, there's some other sources of data that have been recommended that you've talked about. I'm happy to do research and work with you to get that so that everybody has access to it. But is there anything we didn't discuss today when we talk about the big picture and the scope of the problem?
Can I say something?
Sure, Mr. Vice President. Yeah, you're the Vice President of the Council. You can say a lot.
I know we briefly mentioned mental health, but it's a huge problem. As many of you heard me say, the jail is our biggest mental health provider in the city, and I think it needs to be a part of this discussion. And we're doing some things with mental health as a council, funding. I won't go into them right now, but we've scratched the surface. But it continues to be a significant problem and ought to be on the table somehow.
Okay. Any other questions? Any other discussions? Go ahead.
Yeah, so my name is Jose Morales. I am from the Center for Independence, Jacksonville. To piggyback on what Sharon here tomorrow was saying, if we could add, just, you know, like we were talking about the resource directory that can be created, the campaigns, just being from the disability community and even running we run a medical equipment lawn closet program and things like that. There is people with disabilities without insurance. Just adding that accessibility component to the discussion, no pun intended, to the equal access discussion, that I think if we could add, you know, make sure that we have that in the discussion as we're going forward, the Mayor's Disability Council actively has a working group. Anybody that can join us in helping us bring back information to this group to achieve that will be greatly appreciated. I'm more than available to help with any in that subject, so nothing. That's my input. Just adding, making sure that we add the ADA and the accessibility discussion to everything to the access to healthcare.
And to that end, I want to commend Kara Tucker. I mentioned it to Rachel in the back of the room that the Disabilities Department does have an extensive resource booklet But as I mentioned to Kara the first time I saw it, this should be made available to everyone, because I think a lot of the resources that we just talked about today may very well be in this material already.
Okay, then before we go to a nice...
We got another question here.
Go ahead.
Cheryl Johnson from Hearts for Mind. So just for the group and hospital system members who know this, there is an online electronic resource that all of the hospital systems have signed off on called AMPRTHA. It goes back to a lot of what everybody is talking about. It's great that the hospital system knows about it, but our community doesn't. They don't know how to access it. It's not necessarily easily navigable. So there are some things that can be done, both to connect people to AMPRTHA if they're looking for the robust resources, but also to overlay, Ashley Pratt and I were talking about it, a little more friendly, quick assessment process on top of the technology platform that would help people navigate a massive list of resources that they may have a difficult time knowing exactly where to go. So just to highlight that there, again, one of the biggest gaps is people getting connected to a resource, not just a database or not just a book, because it is hard for an individual to actually determine where they need to go for help by just having a list of providers. So if there is something out there we could probably pivot and capitalize on, but obviously we need to figure out how not to, I don't do the eat the elephant, I do the boil the ocean, how not to boil the ocean, and just kind of find the places where we can make the most impact and try and target the highest number of people who need help.
Yeah. All right, thank you. Before we go to the next, I just want to thank Susan for that great presentation and for all the answers. So thank you. Let's give her a big hand. She did a really great job. So any other member discussion? Okay, so now by law we have to have public comment, but I'm sure we don't have any public comment, but by law I have to say that. Oops. Do we have any public comment? Oh, I guess we do. Okay.
So you're good?
Yeah,
I'm good. Okay, good. No. Take the microphone.
Sorry, right behind.
I just want to echo what Jose said regarding accessibility. That is a huge component. I understand that health care and the access to insurance is paramount, but if you have those things in place and still cannot access health care, and I'm talking about all of it, okay, top to bottom, vision, dental, medical, I can't access. There's a problem. So to the people in the room, the Mayor's Disability Council meets on the first Tuesday of every month, and the Jacksonville Transportation Advisory Committee, because everyone said transportation is a problem. I'm not really understanding that, because I think we have solutions to that. So JTAC meets on the second Monday of every month, and to the hospital personnel that are in the room, we'd love to have you at either one of those to help us address the transportation and the accessibility component to healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you. Now I'm going to turn it over to Paul and Jennifer for best practices.
All right. So thank you for sharing. And I think, you know, there's the hospital systems and other providers here, and I think we can have a conversation about accessibility and transportation. You know, I want to hear about some of the best practices that are going on right now. You know, I've got a lot of experience in other communities. I've had some conversations with our university systems about doing some mental health support services. We built a program down in Tampa with the colleges with five academic institutions, calling Your College Cares and connecting mental health resources to college students and incoming freshmen as well. And so we're starting to do a lot of these things, but I'd love to hear about some of the best practices here. I also have, and there's also some other people in this room that are not here that represent large funded opportunities, you know, to connect. So I'm thinking, you know, Blue Zones and what Dr. Goldhagen is doing. You know, this doesn't happen to have, it doesn't have to be in a silo, right? This can be a component of the other operations that are going on because they are funded and they are moving forward as well. And so, you know, we need to have representation from those organizations here so that we understand, you know, what road they're going to travel. And maybe that helps us to make a little bit better decision on where we need to travel as well. So go ahead with your comment.
Sure. I've been sitting here, and you all that know me, I don't talk a whole lot sometimes. But, ooh, you're burning me up over here, I'll just tell you. Because I'm Faye Johnson, for you all that do not know me, with the Northeast Florida Healthy Start Coalition. And one of the best practices, unfortunately, came out of the death reviews of babies that did not live to their first birthday. Our role in the community as the maternal child health lead is to look at those systems of care that are impacting our babies living past their first birthday. And unfortunately, there are many factors that impact that. One being is the social determinants of health that we have addressed for the last 10 to 15 years. Because that is the health of the mother. That's what's driving the health of our families. Where they live, work, break, and play drives the conditions of our families. So when we think about that, one of the best practices, unfortunately, came out of the death reviews where we had 2019 funding was provided by UFL, Baptist, and Florida Blue to review all of the death records of the babies that did not live to their first birthday. And what we saw was the health of the mother before pregnancy was the indicator that that was going to be a poor health outcome. Chronic disease, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, chronic stress, toxic stress, those type of things drive infant mortality. So when we look at this, for me, you got to look deeper, you got to go upstream. The health of the mother started a long time ago when she was an adolescent. So you still have to go upstream in preventative care. If you're really going to get to the nick of all of the problems, you have to look at that. So one of the things we did temporarily, not temporarily, but came out of the death reviews, we saw a disconnect in the medical provider offices and what was going on in the outside of the world, the social determinants of health. So through Baptist, we put a system of care pilot in place where we place a family partner in doctor's offices because the doctors are busy doing their medical thing. They needed someone in the offices to address the social determinants of health. So we partnered with, through our Zero Preventable Leadership Council, which Councilman Salem was a part of that, we partnered with two doctor's offices, where our goal is four, more than that if we can, to put a family partner in the offices as a best practice to address those social determinants of health. When a woman is not showing up for her appointments, her lights may be off. She may not have any food. So just don't assume she's non-compliant because she's not coming to the appointments. We have to address the real issues and get down to the bottom of it. So for me, I'm sitting here. I don't know where we're going to land, but I'm going to stay right here until we land because there's a lot to do. Thank you.
Okay.
And I think just to follow up, Faye, thank you for sharing that best practice. I'm going to reach out to see what we can have to prepare for the next meeting. But we do want meeting two to be a focus on the best practices. So think about what you use that is a best practice and share that with us. And that's what we want to present to then move to the next step. So that is a great example of a best practice that we'd love to get between now and our next meeting on the 29th.
I just might add, too, that Dr. Marlin from the city will be at that meeting to talk about the city's contributions to many of the programs in the area. It's really important for us to understand, as you just shared with us, what's happening in our community and who's doing what and who you're serving as a part of that process. So that's, if you will, almost a SWOT, kind of an internal SWOT kind of piece to this process. And then from there, we'll then reach out to find out what's happening in other communities beyond Jacksonville.
And Anne-Marie, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit about the food pharmacy. And I think that's a great best practice, right, is starting to look at understanding the social determinants, then providing the food, providing the education, starting to look at chronic disease. And so I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that, whether it be today or next time, but I think that's a great best practice.
Thank you, Paul. So the food pharmacy is a pharmacy.
Can you just a little bit today, and because we run out of time.
It is a pharmacy. It's basically the same thing you do when you go to a super regular pharmacist. Your doc says you need X. In this case, it's actually food. We target our patients who have hypertension, diabetes, other chronic diseases that would benefit.
tend they have to be food insecure. So they answer the questions around social determinants of health. It is grant funded by many partners, including me and I. Excuse me. Laura Blue and others. And the goal is to solve that little piece. What it doesn't solve, but I'll be frank in putting out there, is if a person can't come to the food pharmacy physically, I got a barrier, but I'm working on that. So far, diabetics have improved their A1C. 76% of our diabetics have improved it under 7.0. And those who have hypertension, whatever rates their doctor wants them to get to, 62% of those patients. It's working, but it has Cinderella slippers. When the funding runs out, like most programs, it will go away, unless you guys want to get some
money. Okay, next. Who we serve? Okay.
All right. So I think we've already had the conversation about who we serve with this, right? I mean, there's a lot of different people. I also alluded to it at the beginning, or stated it at the beginning of the meeting. Who is missing? You know, I've written a list of people that I know that probably need to be here, other communities that need to be represented in this room as well. And so you all have great networks of people and great experience in the community. Invite them. Right. And let's have a conversation. Give them the idea that we want to hear about best practices. If somebody's doing great work, have them come share the story about what they're doing. And we'll all come back with some other ideas as well on best practices that are going on, not just here, but, you know, across the state or across the country as well.
Jennifer, you got anything on that?
No.
Can we share
thank you.
A participant list? Because it would help them identify who's not.
Yeah. I think we can.
Targeted. Yeah, we can do that.
Okay.
All right. I want to thank everyone for coming to today. It was really informative, and we got a lot of work to do. Any other comments on this committee before we end it? And I want to thank my two co-chairs for really stepping up and doing this. Like I said, because I'm not an expert, I'm just kind of here helping out. And so thank you so much for this. Thank you for the chairman. Thank you to each and every one of y'all. Meeting is adjourned.
Oh, no. We got to make sure we're capturing this.
And yeah.
And share with everybody.
And really, where are you? I don't know. I'm here almost just a parking lot. That garage has nobody in there.
Again, if we can help out on the process, like not working, definitely support whatever. I was just telling Sharon, there's a lot of innovation that we can provide to you. Like, you know, inclusive.
Can I tell you the funny story?
And you know, a lot of people with disabilities, especially in the early stages, don't have the benefits.
I have a lot of
people need that stuff, so, and vice versa, they don't see a lot of stuff anymore. So,
a bunch of stuff.
If we can help with that, we can make that
better. Everybody just walk around the room. You give like 3 minutes and people are right on the
paper. That's what I was searching when I was doing this.
And then you give everybody 5 stickers and you say, go put your sticker on. And they're like, they're questions where it's not like, what are the strengths? It's like roundabout questions that get to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I mean, you
know, it's just, it's faster.
That's why I broke out my notes for this meeting. I went through them so well.
Like, I didn't hear a single, like, Amory said, anybody hear something new? Yes. So you guys do it the best way. Just love the awareness and helping people understand and market the nonprofits and the system came up. I'm like, all we gotta do is put more resources, Jones County, and do the model, like Faye, and tie it in with